Well, let's give this a whirl again. MN350 welcomed longtime Minnesota educator and social justice organizer Sam Grant to its staff as executive director at the end of March. And he's no doubt had a pretty interesting few months on the job. Hey, Sam, good morning. Are you there?
Good morning. I'm here.
Yay! I love it when a plan comes together. Well, congratulations on your new gig, but wow, what was it like starting a new job? Obviously, a lot of the contacts and the work were not unfamiliar to you, but what was it like starting a brand new gig as the head of an organization in the midst of a pandemic?
Well, actually, I started at the end of February, so I had 2 weeks of normal.
Oh, you had 2 weeks!
Yes.
Oh, well, piece of cake then, right?
Yeah, and then we're sitting in the office. I think it was Monday, March 16th, just after the pandemic. It started on about March 13th, you know, here locally. And, you know, we were saying, we better think about how we can work remotely. And one of our staff said, hey, I think there's one of our major donors who would probably be willing just to make sure everybody on staff could have the personal Zoom account. Why don't I call her? So checked in with that major donor, and she automatically got Zoom accounts, you know, set up for all of us. So we have been working remotely with appropriate technology, and it's been easier than I certainly imagined it would be. Kind of seemed like it would be impossible and we would all fall apart, but we're still working pretty effectively and getting a lot of great work done.
I'm so tempted. Radio doesn't really work that way, but I have to say I am so tempted sometimes, and I just got to get my act together, to do the Zoom meeting from my back deck. And I'm sort of thinking that, you know, you guys could be out in nature. You know, you could be hiking a local trail and you could be at your Zoom meeting and you'd kind of be fulfilling your corporate mission at the same time as you were doing the thing.
Well, that is actually true. And we do have staff, you know, Zoom in to meetings, you know, from their garden. We've had staff Zoom in to meetings while they were on a road trip to, you know, California or in the Colorado Rockies. So it gives people that opportunity to be wherever they choose to be, but still get their work done. As long as they have a stable internet connection, which is sometimes an issue.
Right. Right. That's why the backyard is a great place for that sort of thing. I was interested when I took a look at this news release, though. Boy, you didn't waste any time just jumping right in when the EPA said that it was going to abandon its mission and stop enforcing environmental regulations during the pandemic. You waded right into that controversy. Talk about that just a little bit.
Well, in the absence of strong enforcement and regulations to protect, you know, the integrity of nature, humanity's safe operating, environmental dynamics fall apart. So if the agency at the federal level that we have to rely on to protect our clean air, water, and other standards begins to unravel, that's a high alarm situation. So we have no choice but to, you know, add our voice to the need to defend ecological integrity. So it's kind of an automatic. You can't stop. You got to stop. You can't do that.
You know, there have been calls, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but there have been calls for, campaign finance reform and that kind of thing. And the idea about donors making, you know, direct contributions to politicians and affecting policy, that sort of thing. You've been critical about how fossil fuel interests have been able to undermine/corrupt environmental protections and organizations in this country. What would be the best way of putting a stop to that?
Well, it's not a short answer, not an easy question, but I think that when World War II ended and we had an abundance at that particular moment of fossil fuels, and we had an opportunity to sort of foster a whole new horizon of economic growth through fossil fuel energy for our civilization, we kind of went, hog wild with it. And I think even before the end of World War II, back in the late 19th century, there were scientists who had come out with some conclusions of global warming as a possible reality and something to be concerned about. But as early as 1957, the American Petroleum Institute had received a scientific assessment and said, even though you can make a lot of money and facilitate a lot of progress with fossil fuels, it is going to hurt the environment, and it's eventually going to hurt most of humanity. So you ought to probably invest in renewable energy and do things that don't, cause this level of harm. And then every decade, new scientific evidence kept coming out saying this is not the right way to continue to fuel civilization. And the fossil fuel companies did what they were encouraged to do by their shareholders, did what they were supported to do by all of us consumers who were loving all of these great, fabulous products that we got in the, the age of oil and gas. And so none of us, not enough of us anyway, said stop. And what's happened from the 1950s to the present is more and more people are saying stop. We can't continue to have a civilization based on fossil fuels because it is reaching a point, even at 1 degree Celsius climate change, we've reached a point of massive feedback loops that are moving risk into a higher profile for more and more people on the planet. There's certain, ecosystems on the planet in tremendous harm's way. And there's certain vulnerable populations, our people living on the island nations, people living on seacoasts, in poor countries in particular. The problems are getting out of hand. And so we really have no choice but to do something different. So I think the question that's up for us now is how are we going to transition, not whether the transition, but how are we going to transition? So as we communicate and do litigation with fossil fuel companies now, we're simply doing some of the necessary measures that we have available to us to put higher pressure on existing norms, to create incentives for norms to replace these ones.
Sam, I'm going to change the topic just a little bit. Okay. You've begun your tenure as the executive director of MN350, and you were interviewed by the New York Times just at the beginning of last month about climate change and also anti-racism. They interviewed a variety of black climate activists, and you're actually the first person that pops up in the article. Do you feel that it's a good thing or a peripheral thing that your identity as a person of color becomes a part of what you do and people ask you questions about it and you're subject to interviews about it?
It's unfortunately not peripheral because I think people call people like me because I have a black body when something like this happens. So I'm not sure I would have been called by anybody and there wouldn't be any media play for me in particular around this. But because I am black and I lead a significant environmental organization, then that intersection, sort of sets me up to be one of the people who was called when George Floyd was murdered by the police. So it's not something to be happy about, and it's not something that any of us choose. It's just part of how structural racism and identity still are significant variables in how our lives actually play out, you're on the earth right now.
But as you go through your day-to-day work and your day-to-day job, and people like me call up and talk about you being an environmental leader, but also, oh, by the way, you're a person of color, and what is this like, and start asking questions, do you see that in, would you rather be talked to just about environmental issues, or do you feel as though this idea of systemic racism. We had Dudley Edmondson on the show last week, and he talked about being a black naturalist and a person of color who is a nature photographer and who leads hikes and, not only for kids and for groups, but also here in our community, just people in our community. And he talked about how hostile some of these environments can be for people of color. Do you feel as though that's a part of your mission, I guess, as you go forward in your work?
I think that I'd encourage the people who are listening to the show to Google Nathan Hare, African-American sociologist who wrote an article in the Journal of, I think it was in the Black Scholar in 1970, and it's called Black Ecology. And in that article, he says that, you know, as folks from, you know, the mainstream community who identify as white frame environmental issues, they think about humans as separate from nature. But for African Americans, we think about humans as part of nature. And so there's an obvious connection between harm to nature and harm to people. They're not separate realities. They're part of the same reality. So I don't think it makes sense to distinguish racial justice and climate justice or gender justice or economic justice or border justice. I think all of those things fit together. So for me, as an African-American person, you know, like Dudley, who I know and highly appreciate, I'm also an amateur birder. I don't know as much about, you know, getting out into nature and honoring those things as much as he does, but I do that when I can. So when I talk about climate change, I talk about two forms of inhospitable climate. There is the inhospitable climate of having a identity that is not welcome, and you feel that unwelcome in many different ways all day long. For people like Dudley and myself, when we're out in nature, there's a risk that we're going to be scrutinized in a way that other people who are out enjoying nature are not. So there's a famous story of an African-American ornithologist in Central Park who saw a woman who didn't have her dog on a leash, and he told the woman to put her dog on a leash, and then he got arrested and in trouble with the police for simply doing what any other person would have done.
And she played on that deliberately. They pointed out that she played on that deliberately, that she knew and was very calculated and knew that if she made this phone call and said, a black man is frightening me, that the police would you know, run and come down on this gentleman. And I think it was the calculating nature of this. You know, she's obviously very much aware of her white privilege, and she was going to use it as a stick in this instance. It was ugly.
It's ugly, and it's also sometimes when we get triggered, we grasp for whatever thing we can hold on to that allows us to feel powerful again in that moment. And so, unfortunately, race is such a trigger for white people. So this has happened constantly. It's not a rare, novel thing that this happened to this gentleman. It happens constantly where that ends up being a variable when a white person makes a call and it happens to be, or it's alleged to be, an African-American. So even if it's just a smoking gun and it's not an African-American that did anything, if you say an African-American did it, you're going to get a faster response.
Do you feel that in your capacity as a leader of an environmental organization, Dudley talked about bringing people that he knows and meeting people and bringing them even from a different part of Duluth to go hiking and out into natural spaces, because the people have never, it's never really occurred to them. Either it's a transportation issue, or they think, I don't know what kind of an environment it's going to be when I get out there. I don't know if people are going to be mean to me. Who needs that? So they don't go. Do you feel as though a part of your mission is to perhaps encourage black, indigenous people of color to join efforts for environmental advocacy and perhaps to have a more of a voice, more of a seat at the table, bringing the knowledge and wisdom that they share about environmental issues to the table?
I certainly feel like that's a necessary obligation of mine. If you think about MN350, I mean, our staff is almost half people of color. Our board is maybe 40% people of color at this point, but our volunteer base is almost entirely white. And so the people who have come into this movement in Minnesota sort of match the majority culture here in Minnesota. And I have made the commitment that we're going to be intentional about continuing to sustain the investment of all of those folks who are part of MN350 now, but also taking significant effort to bring in people who have not felt like the way the issue of climate change has been framed is actually relevant to their lives. So we're telling a story of relevance to people in Native nations, the story of relevance to people in poor rural communities, and the story of relevance to people in inner city communities who are suffering on days like yesterday from the tremendous heat island effect and the high humidity. So they live in substandard housing. They have to pay a lot more for air conditioning. And the tree canopy was knocked down in North Minneapolis by the tornado in 2011. So that heat island effect is even more extreme in neighborhoods without a tree canopy, which tend to be the poor neighborhoods. So you have higher energy costs because you live in a poor neighborhood. You have less tree canopy because you live in a poor neighborhood. You have less access to fresh food because you live in a poor neighborhood. You have further to go to get to work because you live in a poor neighborhood and have to rely on transportation systems that weren't designed for your well-being. You're less likely to have a car, less likely to have a bank account, more likely to have, you know, economic duress because you have a job that is trapped in the low-wage sector. I consider all of those to be environmental issues. As we think about a rapid transition towards renewable energy, we're interested in trying to support folks in those situations to get the caulk guns out and do an energy efficiency campaign in those communities to address the impediment of substandard housing. We're interested in getting those people connected to the green jobs that are necessarily coming as we begin to move away from fossil fuels into wind and solar. We're interested in having those people become practitioners of environmental health, looking at the intersection of the health of the environment and the health of human bodies. In North Minneapolis, there's more bad air that stays circulating over that community over a long period of time because of the way air moves as it comes, you know, through downtown Minneapolis. It sort of stays over a longer period of time right where there happens to be 11 companies that are putting toxic stuff into the air, soil, and water. And so North Minneapolis residents have higher asthma, higher respiratory illness. They tend to live 11 to 13 years longer. Those are environmental issues. So I think we can make the case that all of those issues are connected to the issue of climate change, because climate change is happening because human beings have not paid good enough attention to our relationships with nature or each other. We want people to take advantage of this challenge as an opportunity to heal our relations with the earth and heal our relations with each other. And we think that's a story that can resonate with most of humanity. So that's the approach we're taking.
Sam, what a pleasure to talk with you this morning. I wish we had more time. We've taken quite a bit as it is. I appreciate the time that you've given us this morning. Thanks so much for being our guest. And if you get up in this neck of the woods, stop in and say hi.
I will do that. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Sam Grant, our guest this morning, the executive director of MN350. Green Visions on KUMD is made possible with support from Heritage Window and Door, the Duluth Superior Supplier for Renewal by Anderson Windows and Doors, and from Minnesota Power Energy Conservation Program, making progress toward a lower carbon energy future.